Outside of the Beatles themselves and their producer George Martin, no one has listened to more of the Beatles' recorded music than author Mark Lewisohn. He has also written extensively about the Beatles, including the acclaimed Beatles Recording Sessions book, and he is now working on a major biography project on the Beatles, and he joins us from his home office in England. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just very briefly, remind me how you came to this opportunity to be the one that was able to just listen from start to finish to all the Beatles recordings.
Sure. It's actually a very long time ago now, virtually 20 years ago, not quite today, but nearly. I had been a fan of the Beatles since childhood, since 1963, when I was an infant, but still a keen admirer of them. And that had never really stopped. And I was always interested in finding things out about them. It's something that's been with me for the whole of my life. I'm still doing it. And when I turned 21, I could finally gain access over here in England to a library which doesn't permit under 21s, but I always knew would be good for research. I was always keen on research, and that is the British Museum's newspaper library, an amazing resource. And as soon as I went in there, I started to discover information about the Beatles that was contrary to, or indeed far better than, information that had been published about them. So I began to research aspects of the Beatles' career with a view to I don't quite know what, but eventually 7 years later a book emerged, and that was a guide to every live engagement, every live performance the Beatles had ever given. And this book was received quite well by a lot of people, Beatles included, and by EMI. And I had a relationship with EMI anyway by this point, and they said to me, well, you've turned a book of basically dates and places of where the Beatles played into an interesting read when it could have been just a list. How would you like to do the same with the Beatles recording sessions? Now, I'd been going past Abbey Road studios and looking at it longingly since childhood. So the opportunity to go and work there for the best part of a year and to listen to all of those tapes, none of which had been heard by members of the public before, and write a book about it was obviously a dream.
Your heart must have dropped out when you heard that offer come to you.
I can still remember the phone conversation when it was put over to me, and I mean, I literally only took a second to say yes. I mean, the details were worked out later, but on principle alone, the answer had to be yes. And that's what happened. January 1987, I found myself in Abbey Road, not only listening to all the tapes, but meeting all the engineers and all the people who had worked on the sessions, speaking to session musicians, basically speaking to anyone who had any involvement in the Beatles' creative work at Abbey Road. And 18 months later, a book emerged, another book, and that was the Beatles Recording Sessions.
Right. Well, let's jump into our discussion about Revolver. You wrote in that book that Revolver would, quote, change the course of popular music. So how so?
Well, the pop album had been invented in the 1950s, so it was still a relatively young format. I don't suppose anybody had anticipated how it might change, or whether indeed any change was ever going to be necessary. But looking back on it, with hindsight at least, it seems clear now that something so new wouldn't just be the way it started. The Beatles themselves, when they began making albums in 1963, basically had to fall into the ongoing practices, and that meant, in their case, issuing an album of quickly recorded material. The whole thing was done in a day. And it being essentially just a collection of songs, unrelated, but the only unifying thing being they were the same performers and the same producer, but that was about it. Their progression, their inquisitiveness in the studio was making things different as they went along, in that by the time we're only a year on, 1964, their records are sounding more cohesive, more slick. I'm thinking of the Hard Day's Night album, for example, is an outstanding collection of pop songs, still 13 different tracks, but undoubtedly the genre is beginning to mature, and this was a process they continued through. Rubber Soul is obviously a landmark, 1965, but again it's still unconnected songs, but there is clearly a theme emerging in that, you know, they're all the process of greater thought and greater creativity in the studio, and they're beginning to use the studio more experimentally. They were not alone in doing this, of course not, but they were always out front. Revolver was just that bit different again, in that this was no mere collection of pop songs. This is now a different beast. The Please Please Me album, you know, any one of those tracks, in a way, they could have been singles. They weren't, but they could have been. With Revolver, you've got something that is clearly put together for the long-playing format. In other words, it's beginning to mature, and it's beginning to become different from just collections of songs. And the Beatles' ideas and the way that they worked on that album were just so different from anything that had gone before, that it was a revolution. It was literally a revolver, a revolution in one.
So as we said, you've listened to all the tapes from all the sessions. Could you tell when you got to this phase, Rubber Soul, Revolver, that something was different just in how the tapes sounded?
Well, obviously, when I was doing that research at Abbey Road, I was well aware of how the story would unfold, and therefore I had that hindsight, which in a way spoiled it slightly. I do believe you can never actually beat the unfolding of a story naturally as it occurs. But I knew what was coming, and it's just clear that even though they're still working on fairly primitive equipment and only four-track recording tape, which is laughable now, it's clear purely from the techniques that they're using that they themselves are trying something new. They were always restless for new sounds, and Revolver has that running all the way through it. I mean, and listening to the tapes in conjunction with the recording sheets, which is kind of the engineer's log of every session, you would see how they would spend 7, 8, 9 hours doing maybe only a take or two, or just a few overdubs. And quite clearly, this was becoming the product of a great deal of thought and experimentation, and no doubt a lot of lazing around as well. But at the same time, they were doing things very differently from how they had been. And the sounds, yes, the sounds leapt off the tape as being radically different.
Could you talk about the role of George Martin and engineer Jeff Emerick at this stage in Beatles recording history?
Well, George Martin and Jeff Emerick had, George Martin certainly had been the Beatles producer from the beginning. And initially his role was simply to arrange slightly, to make sure that the song had a strong beginning, a good middle, and a good ending. Often the Beatles, or Lennon and McCartney's songs, would have that already, but sometimes they didn't, and he would need to, you know, suggest alterations. By 1966, though, the whole concept was different, in that they knew themselves what they wanted to achieve, and George became a realizer of their ideas, and this required someone who was enormously sympathetic to the way that they worked, and even more importantly, the way that they thought. They respected him, he respected them, and the combination was the best any creative combination could ever be. The role of the engineer had always been, well, an important one, no question about it. I mean, to actually commit the sounds of the music making to tape is essentially the engineer's role. But with Revolver and this young man, Jeff Emerick, who came onto the sessions for the first time, the Beatles suddenly had someone who was very keen to break the rules. Now, this was perfect for them, because they themselves were rule breakers extraordinaire. And so it was a very good combination indeed, because he didn't need to be told to try something new and fresh and unusual, whether it worked or otherwise. Jeff just did it, and they liked that, and it was perfect for their sound.
So among the innovations that came out of this period was something called artificial double tracking, which you make some detailed points about in your book, is coming up on just about every vocal track on Revolver. Could you talk a little bit about how that came into play? And I should mention, Mark, sometimes when I ask a question, since I'm probably not going to present this in pure interview format, you know, if you could kind of start with artificial double tracking was blah, 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 or something, you know, just keep in mind that this format won't probably make it to the final program. But
right. Okay. Well, artificial double tracking was a device that was essentially invented at the Beatles' request, in that they loved to try new things, but they could also be very bored very easily. And ever since 1963, they had been keen, in fact, ardent double trackers. They liked to thicken their sound. John, in particular, once he discovered double tracking, very rarely issued anything that wasn't double tracked, because he liked the sound of that on his voice. But double tracking was a chore. It basically entailed manually singing along with your own previously recorded vocal track, so that you've got two vocal tracks. You've got to virtually replicate the way you sung it the first time, and John in particular was not very good at replicating anything a second time. It was always going to be different next time he did it. So this was something that they needed but didn't really enjoy doing. And one day at the Revolver sessions, John said, apparently, I wasn't present, but those who were there tell me that he said, isn't there any way we could do this automatically? I mean, you know, we've got technology, can't we just, you know, invent some new way? And Abbey Road being what it was, it and EMI being the company that it was, there were technical staff on the premises who liked a challenge. And there was a guy there called Ken Townsend, in his white lab coat, which is what they all wore, who went away and thought about it and wondered whether indeed it could be done automatically or artificially. And hey presto, he came back the next day or soon after with this idea of, well, essentially running this. I'm not very technical, and it's some years since I was actually told all of this, and I'd need to gen up on it again myself, but essentially it's some method of running the same track through over the recording head with a very slight delay, and you could vary the delay depending on how fat or echoey you wanted the sound, but the merest fraction of a delay would just repeat the vocal track, as it were, but just that very slight bit behind. The consequence being like placing two negatives on top of one another, but having one very slightly off. You've got a thicker sound. You've got the two voices. You can hear two voices, even though it's only been recorded once. And they called it flanging. And in fact, it became known as Ken's Flanger, after Ken Townsend. And ultimately, that invention, ADT, artificial double tracking, went into, I think, every recording studio in the world.
Let me start with Paperback Writer, which is the single that was recorded at this time. And I know that a lot of people have written about the groundbreaking bass guitar sound on this record. Do you recall some of that discussion and how that came about for this?
When Paperback Writer was recorded, it had a very prominent and noticeably prominent bass sound, as did the other side of that single, Rain, as well. This was just another typical byproduct of the fact that they were looking for new sounds, that Paul was using a different bass on the Revolver album. He wasn't using his Hofner, he was using, I think, a Rickenbacker. But you can correct me on that if I'm wrong. And they had this new engineer who was determined to mic things closer and put more sound on tape. The engineer, incidentally, Jeff Emmerich, got into trouble with the management at EMI in Abbey Road, because the way that things were done wasn't merely the province of the engineers who worked there. It was actually set down that you could not exceed a certain number of decibels, you could not go into the red for any longer than X number of seconds, if at all. These were prescribed working practices, and Jeff Emerick was as determined to break them as the Beatles were to break, you know, other ways of recording. So this was something that they concocted between them, Paul McCartney and Jeff Emerick, and I think trouble was caused as a result of it. But things needed to change, you know. I mean, this was not the 50s anymore. We were in the mid to late 60s at this point. So Paperback Writer was a very progressive sounding record as a result. In fact, it was so progressive that it didn't go down very well with the public. It was easily the least selling Beatles single in Britain. I'm not so sure about America, but in Britain it certainly was. And it took them some time to actually recover from that. It was number one for only a couple of weeks, but more to the point, it sold significantly fewer copies. And I think it caused some heads at EMI to be rather concerned that perhaps the Beatles were slipping, which of course they weren't, but you know, that was the way it looked for a while.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because I a little bit older than you, but I guess I was all of 10 when this came out, and I kind of remember being a little bit challenged by the change in the sound and the experimentation that was so evident on this particular album by the Beatles. Do the history books show any hesitation from the public or any concern? Were critics challenged by this new freedom and this new sound that the boys were putting out?
Well, looking back to 1966-67, it's clear that the Beatles were racing ahead in terms of, you know, artistic advancement, but that the public were naturally lagging behind slightly. You know, the Beatles were opening new doors and saying, you know, let's go and record in here and let's see what this sounds like, and the public naturally weren't quite ready for it. The consequence was Paperback Writer was sold in disappointing quantities. It made number one but didn't sell very well. Revolver did better, but it's hard to say exactly what the critics thought of it, because believe it or not, in those days, I know this sounds laughable now, but in those days the newspapers did not review albums. This is as true, I think, in America as it was in Britain. Everything was singles oriented, and in fact even then some of them didn't review singles either. You have to look at the pop papers to see what they thought of the Beatles' work at this point, and they were challenged by it, there's no question about it. However, by the time that Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields and then Sgt. Pepper came out, they were just so refreshingly, wonderfully different that the public just loved it again. Sales of Sgt. Pepper were, quite naturally, as we know, extremely good, and far better than Revolver, and in fact far better than any Beatle record or album had gone before. But at Revolver time in 1966, Paperback Writer and so on, I think people were having a struggle with recognizing exactly what it was the Beatles were trying to achieve.
This might be an opportune time to ask for a few comments about the fact that this album came out in the first week of August in 1966, which was an auspicious week in Beatles history. The world was reacting to John Lennon's comments about the Beatles and Jesus. Could you talk a little bit about that space and time where this album entered the world's consciousness?
Yes, well, the Revolver album came out at the beginning of August 1966 in a week that was, even by the Beatles standards, quite extraordinary. This was the week when the so-called Bigger Than Jesus incident really blew up big in America, and that in turn made headlines in many other countries. The Beatles were about to head off to the States for what we now know was their last tour, but that wasn't realized at the time. And the tour was very nearly cancelled, and the tour began essentially with a press conference in Chicago at which John tried to explain or place into context or qualify in some way his remarks, which had been made many months earlier in England. The Revolver came out right plumb in that time, but do you know, even though we can now see that, I don't really think that the two things were brought together at all at the time. again, we, you know, when you look back at that period, you have to realize that the circumstances and the way that things were appreciated was very different from now. I don't think any article about the Bigger Than Jesus thing even mentioned the fact that the Beatles had a new record out. And indeed, on that tour, which began August 12, 1966, the Beatles didn't perform a single track from their new album. Albums these days are basically, or artists go on tour and promote a new album, the idea being it will push sales. The Beatles went on tour and didn't even mention their new album. So the two things were really quite distinct. They happen through sheer happenstance to have occurred in the same week, but in every other respect, the two stories don't belong together at all.
Let me ask you about the flip side of Paperback Writer then briefly, because there were a couple of things. I know that this was recorded shortly after the sessions for Tomorrow Never Knows, but this was the first time that listeners had a chance to hear some of this experimentation. And the things you mention are the variable speeds on tape playback that they were using, and also backwards vocals used at the end of this record. Could you talk a little bit about the experimentation on Rain?
Yes, well, Rain is a good example of the Beatles' new use of the studio. Ken Townsend had gone away and come up with this artificial double tracking. And one of the products of that was it enabled the Beatles, through basically playing around with electrical current, they could slow down or speed up the motor on the tape machine, which meant that vocals, or anything indeed, could sound very different if slowed down or sped up. I mean, if you slow something down when you record it, when you play it back at normal speed, it sounds fast, and vice versa. So the Beatles were always very keen users of any new toy, and they would usually use it to death and then ditch it. And vary speed as a result is all over the Revolver album. And it just, when used with instruments, it changes the texture, and when used with voices, it literally changes, well, the texture again, but also the whole, everything changes, the pitch, the timbre of the voice. So Rain has a lot of vary speed on it. It's still a very easy recording in that it was done on four-track tape, but they were bouncing by this point, which meant that they would record certain tracks on... and then mix those down to another tape and then use the vacant tracks on that tape again. So maybe they were using 7-8 tracks ultimately to make a recording. The vocal on Rain is a tremendous John Lennon vocal. I mean, there is no way here that he's a smiling mop top anymore. You know, when you listen to Rain and you think of the man who sang I Want to Hold Your Hand only 2.5 years earlier, this is a very different human being from that one, or so it sounds. There's a snarl in the voice. He's not smiling at all. And the lyrics are extraordinary. I mean, we're so far removed already from boy-girl love songs. But who told them to do that? I mean, they've soaked up every influence from Dylan onwards and just turned it out into something really fresh and exciting. And then it ends with this wonderful backwards gobbledygook, which is literally a vocal play backwards. Again, backwards tapes would be something that they would embrace for, well, the next year, 18 months. But here, I think, is the first time we actually heard a backwards vocal on a Beatle recording. How it happened, incidentally, is we're not quite sure. This is one of the very few instances where we have a disagreement. John Lennon, who should know, said that this was a result of him arriving home stoned from a session, putting on a 7.5 IPS copy of the Rain recording and putting it on backwards by mistake. George Martin, however, has claimed that he was responsible for this. So we don't quite know how it happened, but there it is on the end of Rain. For anybody listening to a B-side in 1966, it was a real jolting moment, I can tell you.
Well, I think we need to talk about Tomorrow Never Knows, because it is such an adventurous track. What stands out for you about that one?
Well, when I was doing the Beatles recording sessions book and I came to the Revolver sessions, I was trying my best to listen chronologically and for the most part succeeded. And what absolutely threw me, and I hadn't anticipated this at all, was the fact that the closing track on Revolver, Tomorrow Never Knows, which is by some distance its most way out and progressive recording, was actually the first one they did for the album. So the sessions began with, well, it was called Mark One. And I remember quite clearly threading onto the tape machine this original spool of four-track tape. And it, what I heard was just mind-blowing. My challenge was to put it into words and describe it for the readers of the book. Subsequently, it's been released on the anthology album, but do you know, I think my mix was a bit better. I mixed it in the studio right then and there back in 1987 for my listening pleasure only. It wasn't put on tape. And I just thought it was sensational. I mean, you've got so many inventions on the first take, even. You've got sounds being put through electronic, the revolving electronic speaker inside a Hammond organ. You've got tape loops recorded by Paul and John, I think all of them, but certainly by Paul and John, on their machines at home and fed onto, you know, the multi-track tape by ingenious devices. You've got sensational drumming and the drone sound running right through. The Beatles had done nothing like this before.
And all of that was on, or a lot of it was on take one, right?
Absolutely, it was on take one. I mean, Rubber Soul had finished the previous November in a bit of a hurry with some fairly conventional recordings, you know, group sounds, if you like, three guitars and drums still. They'd gone away, they'd had these clearly inspirational few months off, which was, you know, I think key to the Revolver album. And they'd come back in the studio and wham! This extraordinary new sound suddenly came out. And I'd love to have known exactly what George Martin thought of it. And for Jeff Emmerich on his first day, this, I don't know what he thought. I mean, clearly he was keen himself, but I mean, this was phenomenal. This was literally phenomenal. This was a new kind of rock music, literally being invented right there in the studio.
Let me jump to Got to Get You Into My Life, which I'm sure you'll remember the anthology early tape version that was issued on this. What do you find interesting about that early version? And you also talked to the members of the horn section about this, and I'm curious if you might be able to relate a little bit about, you know, their memories of that session.
One of the things about Revolver that is a clear standout is the fact that this was a very, very rich period in the career of Paul McCartney. He'd begun to emerge, well, almost at the beginning of the Beatles, with songs like All My Loving and I Love Her. And then through Yesterday and Michelle had clearly developed a niche for writing extraordinarily melodic pop songs, original and melodic. And Revolver is just McCartney at his very best. On the one hand, he's doing tracks as dynamic and as original as Eleanor Rigby, and as For No One. But on the other hand, he's completely tuned into the kind of Stax, Motown, rhythm and blues sound that the Beatles had always loved, and in particular was very hot in the nightclubs that they used to go to. Paul was really keen on going clubbing in London in those days, and there would usually be basically a rhythm and blues group. Rhythm and blues was always big in London, and there were some great musicians around who really existed only on the club scene, and Paul knew them all well. So he wrote this song, which originally, if you listen to the anthology take, has a kind of a rather spare feeling and some really interesting vocal combinations on it, but ultimately ended up being the recipient of some really bluesy, jazzy sax and horn sound. He got these brass players in from Georgie Fame's Blue Flames. These were all basically black musicians in London, Londoners essentially, who weren't often in the studio, but they were sometimes, but you know, these were club guys, and Paul got them in, and they recorded this great brass sound for Gotta Get You Into My Life, and it just elevated it. So with a very punchy vocal from Paul, this dynamic song, which was good in any arrangement, just really came to life. And you know, it sits there on Revolver alongside Paul's other songs as an absolute high point of his career. I think the years 66 to 69 were probably artistically, so far anyway, have been Paul's peak years, and I think he knows that too, because he often talks about that period as being a very hot one for him.
Let's kind of jump around to some of the different tracks from the different singers, and I suppose we should spend a little time on Yellow Submarine. This track is packed with sound, and your notes make it sound like it was quite a party as they recorded this. What stands out in your memory of hearing this extraordinary track develop on the session tapes?
Yellow Submarine for me was always an odd track on Revolver. It still is. When I play it now, it's I wouldn't be unhappy if it wasn't on that album, and I think a lot of fans and students of the Beatles feel the same way, and yet it is quintessentially them. And it is remarkable anyway in the fact that when they wrote a nursery rhyme, it instantly became one of the world's most popular and enduring nursery rhymes. So this was a group that could do anything and do it well. I played the session tapes for Yellow Submarine with a lot of anticipation, but actually was slightly disappointed in that all of those many and varied sound effects essentially were put down onto the tape in one mélange. They don't exist as separate entities. So I wasn't able to isolate any of the effects individually and really listen to what made up the whole, as it were. And what I heard was not that far removed from the version that came out, except I do recall one very particular and very unusual moment, which was that the song began in its earliest form. It began with Ringo doing a kind of spoken voiceover, as it were, and there was a sound of marching feet, and what he said didn't quite make sense, but it's basically about marching to free the day. I don't know what that meant. It perhaps didn't mean anything, but the marching feet was, I think, coal being slid from side to side in a box. This was a bit like making a radio drama, if you like, and that's what you do in a radio studio. You know, you don't actually go and record marching feet. You put coal in a box and shake it from side to side. So they were making a picture, really, but they evidently decided to chop that beginning off, the version that came out, and I think they were wise to do it, but at least now through the anthology we have been able to hear it.
So in some ways this album was a coming out for George Harrison. He not only got the lead track, he had three songs, which was more than he had on any single Beatles album, I believe. Maybe you could just give a footnote about his contributions on here, starting with Taxman.
Well, George Harrison had been an occasional contributor to Beatle albums before Revolver, usually a track or two, certainly two at the most. But with Revolver, he had three, and out of 14, that was quite a high percentage. And indeed, he had the opening track. Now, this was certainly a first. So George was clearly very involved with Revolver. From the way he talked about it in later years, I always got the impression it was his favourite Beatle album. That and Rubber Soul were those which George most played, I think, in later years, and those which he looked back on with the most affection. So he clearly was involved throughout, and that meant, on the one hand, really good guitar work, of a much higher and more consistent quality, I think, than his previous guitar work. More thought through, more experimental. But on the other hand, it also meant that his compositions were beginning to actually make themselves felt. Taxman is, I would say, the best of the three, but that's in the ear of the beholder, if you like. But it's a stinging, rasping song about a subject which, by all accounts, George was pretty keen on. He was very loathful of the tax man and the extraordinarily high tax rate that the Beatles were subjected to. And this was his rebuttal, really. It didn't change anything, mind you. They still ended up paying the same high level of tax. But it's a much more sophisticated composition than any that have followed. Incidentally, if you look at George's book, I Me Mine, which contains the original items of scrap paper on which he wrote the lyrics for his songs, you'll see quite a different version of Taxman to the one they recorded. And the suspicion is that this is where John Lennon's influence came into play, that the really sharp verbal dexterity of Taxman, with its very snappy and sardonic verses, actually may have come from John Lennon's influence. And with John's brilliant wordplay, I must say it seems reasonable, that theory. But all the same, George sang it wonderfully well with that biting edge that it needed, and the whole album, the whole track is so sharp that it gets the album off to a great start.
And then the anthology version presents an earlier lyrical take that doesn't mention the English politicians.
That's right. The version on the anthology is slightly alternate in that it doesn't mention the leading British politicians of the day, Edward Heath and Harold Wilson, who were respectively the leaders of the Conservative and Labour parties, and they were kind of taking in turns to be Prime Minister. Well, Wilson was a Prime Minister at this point anyway. So to actually mention a real living politician in a song was very daring for the time, not so rare these days, but particularly so then. But in the earliest take, it didn't have it. It had the Beatles doing a different kind of vocal break. It didn't quite work, actually, for my money. I'm so used to the Wilson and Heath version anyway that's the one that I like most. But for me, I think they made the right decision in dropping it, and by really putting the spoke in, to name politicians and say, you know, you, Mr. Politician, you are taxing me too much, and what are you going to do about it? Very direct. And, you know, again, you know, we're only a couple of years away from the cuddly mop tops, and suddenly they're being much more direct and confrontational about wanting change, basically, is what it's about.
Here, There, and Everywhere, you mentioned the harmonies on this being a distinctive element, and I think of songs like This Boy and Because from Abbey Road as stellar examples of how these three, especially, could sing. Could you talk a little bit about George Martin's contribution and the Beatles' skill at this work of harmonizing in this context, and using this as an example?
The song Here, There and Everywhere, another outstanding McCartney piece, by the way, is really embellished by the fact that John and Paul and George had this extraordinary ability to harmonise their vocals quite beautifully. I'm not saying it was totally natural in that they had worked on it in their formative period before they ever got into the studio, but it was clearly something that they could do very well, and that they knew, when used sparingly, could work very well. And they had used it on, well, originally they first used it in the studio on a track called This Boy in 1963, and then they used it on a track called Yes It Is, which was another B-side, this time from 65. And Here, There and Everywhere, they do it again, and even more so than before, this is a track that really owes everything to those harmonies, because it's the harmony that carries the melody line. So that this was something new again for them. They loved harmonies. They had been singing harmonies since, well, probably 1960, 61. I've spoken to people who used to see the Beatles in the Cavern and on other venues on Merseyside in England, and they all talk about how good the Beatles' harmonies were. So this was something that they loved to do. They'd get around one microphone, literally be within breathing distance of one another, and feel each other's breath as well as hearing it, and just glory in these lovely harmonies, usually with Paul doing the higher notes, John doing the lower notes, and George somewhere in between. wonderful combination. They didn't overdo it, but when they did it very well.
In general, we're seeing the, I think outside of yesterday, the first inklings of the Beatles working independently on this album. You've got Eleanor Rigby and you've got Love You Too, which are essentially, you know, McCartney on his own, Harrison on his own. I noticed that John Lennon plays very little guitar on this album overall. I think in the notes there's perhaps maybe four or five songs that he's playing guitar on, and otherwise he's maybe adding percussion and vocals. Could you just talk about that shift a little bit on these recording sessions, and feel free to, you know, mention examples on songs if you like.
Well, the Beatles had always been a group who recorded, apart from very rare examples when someone literally had to be away or wasn't back from holiday or something, they always recorded as a foursome. But that was because they began as a three guitars and drums group, and there would always be a part for everybody on every recording. But as their songs matured, they didn't necessarily require all four to be playing their standard instruments, and sometimes they didn't require four instruments. The first real example of this is Yesterday, where you've got Paul playing an acoustic guitar and singing, and a string quartet. The others aren't on it. It wasn't a slight on them, it was quite simply they weren't needed. The song didn't require drums, so Ringo wasn't on it, and it didn't require a lead guitar, so George wasn't on it, and it didn't require a rhythm guitar, so John wasn't on it. And it wasn't exactly the start of a pattern, it would simply be that they liberated themselves into recognizing that the song would dictate the instrumentation. And therefore, you've got on Revolver, you've got several songs where you don't have necessarily all four playing. George Harrison's song Love You Too is sitar, and it's got other instruments on it as well. It's got a tabla, it's got drums on it, but is Paul playing on it? Is John playing on it? I'm not so sure. And it wasn't always possible to tell from the session tapes, by the way. Similarly, you've got Eleanor Rigby, which is another McCartney song, another ballad, really, although faster tempo. He's on there. There's vocal contributions on there, but there's no lead guitar on there, and there's no drums on there. You've got a string octet, I think it is this time, eight musicians. So the song would dictate. I don't really see it as anything more than that. I don't think it's, you can say, the Beatles are beginning to break up, or the Beatles are beginning to work independently of one another for any other reason than the song. Whereas with the White Album, which would follow a couple of years on, that's a much more clear example of where Paul wanted a drum track on a song, but Ringo was busy, so he went and did it himself. Revolver, the group ethic is still intact, but they're thinking much more about what the song needs rather than trying to find a part for everybody.
Thank you, Mark. Mark, I'm so delighted that you allowed me to talk with you, and I'm excited about having your voice on this project. So, and I know you are very busy, so I really do appreciate you taking time out.
Before we go, it might just be appropriate to do one more question, actually, which is, why is Revolver such a progression? And I think, if I may, having posed that question, answer it immediately. I think the key thing about Revolver, looking back on it now, is the fact that the Beatles have worked very, very hard right from their inception, or certainly from when they went to Hamburg. They had been working like a dog, you could say, or they could say, pretty much every day, several times, several things per day, for years. But at the end of 1965, after their last British tour, they had a long break. They were going to be making their next film, but they couldn't decide what that film would be. And as a consequence, the period of time they had allotted for the film, which was the first 3 months of 1966, ended up being time off. Now, this was the first time they'd ever had the chance to stop and Smell the Roses. Let me say that again, because I heard a pop. This was the first time they'd ever had a chance to stop and smell the roses. And it was also a time, of course, when they were beginning to consume substances which were not entirely legal. And the consequence of the two, of having time off and stretching their mind somewhat, was the fact that they really started to become creative in a different way. They were no longer writing under pressure of a deadline. They were writing because a song would pop up, and they had time to hone those songs, and they had equipment at home to play around with those songs. So even though they brought them into the studio with some work still to be done, they were in essence the product of relaxed thought, and this was something they had never had time for before. And I think that is really the key to Revolver, in that they're now recording artists and not people who just go into the studio and to do an album in the space of a few days because the market demands it. Very key difference.
Mark Lewison is the author of The Beatles Recording Sessions and other books on the Beatles, and he's working on a major biography project to be released sometime down the road. Mark, thank you for talking with us today.
My pleasure.